Start off with the aim, purpose, and types of game. So first thing I'm going to do is talk about me, which of course I enjoy doing a lot. I've been doing training, simulation, and modeling for about 25 years. I went to headquarters at ARC on the planning team there. I've run the command and staff training, a computer system, which is a constructive computer war game. For a few years. I've been on the staff of PGHQ, so I've done the political-military interface type war games. I've done a master's degree in defence simulation and modelling. I then did defence procurement for 5 years, buying simulation systems. And I have seen the best of defence procurement and the worst. So my first year was a brilliant, life-affirming, absolutely wonderful job. Really was. My last year was utterly dire, and I was on drugs for stress and all sorts. But the best way to get over stress at work is to volunteer for an op tour. So I spent 6 months in Baghdad, which was much less stress. And I'm now the directing staff for simulation and modelling at the Defence Academy. Part of my job is internal to MOD consulting on simulation and modelling. And part of that includes manual simulation. So actually, what I'm doing today is part of my job. So any of you who are MOD related and need a bit of advice or just someone to talk to about what you want to try and do, then give me a ring, because it is part of my job to come and help. So, who are you? Okay, so who is a proper civvy? I won't say DSDL, proper civvy, yeah, academics included. Proper civilians, okay? So we've under half the audience. Okay, and defence or defence-related on the other half. Okay, so who's a military wargamer, i.e. a serving soldier or ex? You can be retired. Military wargamer, yeah? Okay, so that's a number. And who would class themselves as a recreational gamer? Yeah? Yes, I'll do recreation as well, yeah. Okay. And who here, business wargaming? Yeah, business wargames. Okay, yeah, there's a few. Names I recognize. Faces I recognize, sorry. Now, analytical games and educational games. So what I want to talk about is, hands up those who normally do the gaming that they do for educational purposes rather than analysis. Oh, okay, that's quite a larger extent than I thought. Okay, so who would actually say they're a newbie here? Ooh. And of those who've stuck their hand up, keep them up. Okay, how many of those are DSDL? So there's five of you. Six, okay, there's a few. Right. So I am preaching to people who of course have, in some cases, infinitely more experience than me. So I'll do my best. Okay, so I'm going to start off with the inevitable definition of a war game, which was in your handout pack. I've fiddled with Peter's definition, because everyone quotes Peter's definition. I fiddled with it, or rather, I'll take the blame, I fiddled with it, although I did steal the fiddling from someone else. Where is Graham? He's around. Adversarial by nature, a war game is a representation of conflict activities, not involving action. Using rules, data, and procedures, in which the flow of events shapes and is shaped by the decisions made by the players during the course of those events. Adversarial by nature. Okay, it's really important. If we don't have a live enemy, we will not get the insights in which we are seeking from a war game. So if it is only one-sided, then it's very difficult to get the full range of insights. It's perfectly possible to do a staff planning game in which only one side is represented and you stop at the plan. But that is only half the story. We also want to make sure that we are using rules, data, and procedures. We need to be able to justify why we've said something. I'm going to do this because of this. Why do you think you succeed? Well, I'm going to succeed because, you know, we always do. Yeah, that's no answer. We need some evidence. And it's particularly true in the world of defence procurement. If you're seeking to buy anything, you must have evidence, you must have numbers that what you're seeking to buy is better than what exists already. And if we're talking about training or the value of education, occasionally that can be quite difficult because people insist on numbers and some things are not amenable to analysis by numbers very easily. We have to get over that. And then we need decisions by the players. There is nothing quite like having an active opposition when you've come up with a genius plan to find that someone scuppers that plan in 5 minutes, as has happened in a Future Force Development exercise quite recently. Now, war games cover a very broad spectrum of activities. I would say all the way from a seminar war game or a bog-sat bunch of guys sitting around a table, all the way up to computer-assisted analytical war games of the sort DSTR have done in the past, where it would take weeks to do 5 minutes of combat. Covering a range in between red teaming, matrix games, free Kriegspiel. Sorry. Does anyone not understand red teaming? Okay, matrix games. Oh, that's brilliant. There's a couple of tentative hands going up. Matrix games are like consensual games where you will make an argument, I'm going to do this because of this, and everyone agrees how likely that is, and we'll roll a dice. Consensual understanding. Free Kriegspiel, you have a combat veteran who makes the decisions, so you're free, there aren't any rules, but the arbiter of good taste is the combat veteran in the room. Rigid Kriegspiel is when we run out of combat veterans and we have to use rules and procedures all written down. The difference between the two is that the rigid Kriegspiel was decided to be very boring by the participants because it would take longer than the real action to do the game, which is why they preferred free Kriegspiel. And then, of course, computer-assisted analytical war game. You're heading towards more rigor and analytical precision down this end. And at this end, you're getting your creativity and original thought. That's the idea. So, to pinch a chapter out of Matt Caffrey's book, I want to talk about von Moltke and what he used to do. Basically, he used to take his officers out to the border, so away from their office, and they'd go and look at a real problem on the border. So they say, right, if the enemy were going to attack across the border, what do you think we should do? Our garrison here consists of this. The amount of warning we'd have would be this. So what would your plan be? And he would select the most junior officer to give his plan. Really, really important. Always ask the junior guy first. And then the next guy, all the way up to the most senior guy. So everyone has given their opinions, and you're getting a bit of a synthesis of ideas. We would then come to, through a discussion, a structured discussion, an understanding of the sort of way in which we'd come up with a plan, in which almost everyone would agree. Then what he would do is split the team in half. Most senior guy to one, next most senior to another. So the red team and the blue team were evenly split in their seniority and experience. And then they would conduct a war game. Because your wonderful plan that you came up with didn't involve the enemy. And now that you're playing against a real enemy who have gone through that thought process, oh my goodness, it really does make a big difference. And then afterwards, once they finished it, they would do a little bit of verification. They would turn out a company of troops from the local garrison and say, as part of our plan, we made an assumption that troops could move from here to here in this time. Let's try it out and check it. And they would do that, and they would get some validation for their plan. And then they would write the whole thing up and put it in as a contingency plan. Now, that, in essence, is the process that what we're trying to do today. Great, it's a brilliant process. You think about it logically, and you would say, yes, I don't have a problem with that. The Kaiser was a great fan of these things. And after von Moltke, the Kaiser, when he got a bit older, would organise them himself. He made one slight change, however. When it came to what's the plan, he'd go, I think it would be a really good idea to do this. And lots of people would go, yes, I think that's brilliant. And I'd like to be promoted as well. So when we're talking about that previous slide, we do have to be careful, because the creativity and original thought can be stifled by the dead hand of the senior officer present, unless that senior officer understands what we're trying to achieve and does, as von Moltke did, get those original ideas out. So when we're down at this end, seminar war games are very vulnerable to a senior officer pontificating at the wrong time. He's absolutely right to pontificate because it is his train set, but he needs to do it at the right time. So if we are after original thought early on, and this is where manual gaming is, that's where the sweet spot of manual gaming is, creativity and original thought, we need to be very wary about senior officers pontificating a bit too much. Okay, so what are we trying to achieve? Well, I've stolen this from Compton and Bartel, and actually from a presentation at Connections earlier this year. Because, of course, manual wargaming consists of stealing ideas and mechanisms from everybody. It's one of the few areas where plagiarism is encouraged, providing, of course, you give credit where credit is due. What are we trying to achieve? Do we have an unstructured problem or a highly structured problem? Are we trying to create knowledge? Are we trying to convey knowledge? Or are we trying to entertain, do a bit of team building with a little bit of the others as a subsidiary aim? So within these areas, there are different types of games, and those are more suited to the type of thing we're trying to achieve. Now, if we're trying to create knowledge in order to buy the right piece of equipment, then it's a highly structured problem and we want to do an analytical game. If we want to understand the effects of the socio-economic effects of using drones, then we might want to have a different type of game. There's a little card game out on drones, which I looked at on PaxSims. And there's a marvellous review by a game site that goes, you've got this game, and the game consists of cards. And the cards are people. And then, of course, you've got a little pack of terrorists. And you're trying to drone strike the enemy's people, and they're trying to drone strike yours. And it has this marvellous mechanism. When you've got the hand of cards, you can lean over with your camera phone and take a picture of the other guy's hand. And then I'm going to drone strike, and you pluck from their hand, and hopefully you've got the right one, and you get 100 points. And if you've got the wrong one, well, you've killed in a civilian. The guy reviewing the game said, it just doesn't work, because actually, within the game mechanism, you just want to strike every turn. Because you get 100 points for getting the bad guy, but you only lose 10 points for killing innocent civilians. And the pack, the hand, is only 6 cards strong. So just strike every time. Therefore, the game's a failure. And I was just thinking, fundamentally failed to understand. That's the whole point of the game, is to understand that. And then, of course, hopefully have a discussion on why 100 points for killing the terrorist and only 10 points for killing a civilian is the wrong maths. And hopefully, in that short example, I give you the difference between analytical and the different ends of the spectrum. So, why are we wargaming? We want to practice decision-making. We want to train people on how to make decisions facing problems that they're going to face. But we want to do it against an opposition. And I'm reiterating it, and I will be a very blunt instrument, and I will keep hammering away at that. Because without an opposition, the enemy has a vote. They really do. as Marshall Slobovinsky at Market Garden said when the general proposed the plan. His comment was Sosabowski. But general, the Germans. Yeah. Okay, so why should we war game? Well, minds much better than mine think that they will produce innovation and original thought. This came out in February. If anyone's not seen it, then they should. And this is Secretary of Defense sending out a memo. And Peter will be talking more on this later. Wargaming is abductive reasoning. I had to check it up on Wikipedia, so don't feel that your knowledge is... new ideas cannot be generated by deductive or inductive reasoning, because deductive reasoning, the conclusions embedded in the premise. This is one where, you know, all bachelors are men, all single, you know, therefore, and that sort of boring logical stuff. Inductive reasoning contains a hypothesis. Every single swan we have seen is white. Therefore, all swans are right based on the sample size of hundreds of thousands of observations which show that every swan is white, until you go to New Zealand and then you find one that's black. Abductive reasoning is what Sherlock Holmes used to do. So no deductions here, all abductions, where you see a number of observations and you connect them together using your imagination and come up with a bit of original thought. And that's what we're trying to achieve. Now, there are misconceptions. Wargaming has a bit of baggage associated with it. Real men don't play war games, and war games aren't going to teach you anything. No, you need to play rugger to do that. Okay, so I would just offer this as a piece of evidence against that, and this is the class of 1927. Okay, and here is the list of major and captains and a young lieutenant, a chap called Dönitz, at the bottom. Now, you may recognize one or two of the names in there. I don't know if the younger people in the audience know anything about German generals, but, you know. At the end of the war, this guy here, Guderian, was the lowest ranking officer. He only made it to general. Every single other person made it to field marshal. Now, I did have somebody say to me, yeah, but these are Hitler's henchmen, you know, of course they got promoted. Well, the ones with a little star or a little plus were actually executed by Hitler or dismissed by Hitler for disagreeing with him. Also, this is 1927. Hitler was only out of jail, he got out late in 1926, and he was forbidden from speaking in public. So in 1927, these people, if they'd have heard of him, would probably think the same of him as the Brits would think of a chap called Nigel Farage. although I ought to be careful with that analogy. So why is this relevant today? Well, Treaty of Versailles limited the size of the German army to 100,000 men. In case of the British army, it's about 100,000 men. They were forbidden from doing large-scale exercises. We don't have any money to do large-scale exercises. They're also forbidden from having tanks. So these guys invented lightning armoured warfare without any tanks. Guderian has in his memoir a delightful comment about driving around in cars with canvas and wood screens on them to make them look like tanks in order to do manoeuvres, and how school children would come up with their pencils and poke holes in the canvas armour, and how humiliating that was. Yes. But it didn't seem to stop them producing some original thought and original tactics. So the class of 1927, as a DS, Defence Academy. As a syndicate, I'm not sure I'd like that syndicate. That might be quite hard work. Okay, the other thing, of course, that we're talking about in war games is rolling the dice, or random number generation, depending on how sensitive you are about dice. And we had a marvellous quote at one of the Future Force development when an action was chosen that would have a significant chance of failure. And a dice was produced, a 10-sided dice. And one of the officers present, I have to say, he's in the army, he said, "Oh, we're playing Dungeons & Dragons now, are we?" To which the correct response is, actually, we need to look at random events. They are important. And they are extremely important how we deal with them. Clausewitzian friction. Everything we try to do is really simple, but the simplest things are very difficult. So we need to take into account breakdowns. We need to take into account weather, and we need to take into account Operation Eagle Claw, when two helicopters crash into each other, trying to rescue the hostages in the embassy in Tehran, and the entire operation goes to ratchet immediately. Whoops. Because understanding that and understanding risk is what it's all about. So if you're uncomfortable with rolling dice, then actually you're uncomfortable with understanding risk. And if you don't understand risk and you're in the army, then there's a slight problem. You really ought to perhaps get another job. And the other thing, of course, about this chap who said we're playing Dungeons & Dragons is it's a 10-sided dice. In order to recognise that, you would have to have played Dungeons & Dragons. So shut up, yeah. Now, from a design point of view, however, we do need to understand how we're going to use probability. So, if, for example, you're driving about in an armoured vehicle in Afghanistan or Iraq or wherever, there's a chance that you'll be blown up by an IED. It's a pure random event. If you are training soldiers, blowing them up at random might be very realistic. As a training objective, it's not very good. What you're trying to do is to stop people getting blown up. And as a result, you would not blow them up at random, because you are training them to look for signs that will stop them getting blown up, the signs of an IED. Now, the reality is, over 15 years and lots of deployments, random chance will kill people. But a very significant amount of time, if people are doing what they're supposed to do, observing what they're supposed to observe, that will save their lives. So in a training system, we would never want to do something like that at random. We would always want to put a clue, which if the student is bright enough, is alert enough, and imaginative enough, they will find that clue and they will avoid getting blown up. Because we want to inculcate that sort of behaviour in them when we're training. So having random chance is something we need to target. Another thing on the understanding that is purpose. If you have a pilot and he gets a lock on, you know, that beep, 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 the enemy missile's locked on me, there are certain things he should do. And those are very quick. You know, drop the flares, bank in a certain direction, you know, wherever the sun is or however. I don't know the precise details. But if he does those, he will have an 80% chance of avoiding getting blown up by the missile. So when we train the guy, if he does those, we won't blow him up. Because we are trying to create that muscle memory that will give him the best chance of survival. Now, of course, you know, Tom Cruise in Top Gun can do something else and avoid being blown up. That's great. He's you know, one of the 5%ers, 2%ers who can do that. But for most of us, it's an 80% chance of survival, and that's what we're trying to do. So my point on rolling the dice is, yes, we need to represent breakdowns because our plans need to be able to cater for those. But there are areas of risk and chance and probability where, depending on the design of the game, we need to very carefully decide when we want to roll the dice or if we want to roll the dice at all. And I'll come on to that in a bit. So why should we wargame? Well, another reason why we should wargame is because our potential adversaries think that it's a good idea. The point about free Kriegspiel depends on having combat veterans. Well, the PLA don't believe they have enough combat veterans because they haven't been involved in enough fighting. So this general is said that all training above battle group level should be adversarial, which in the Chinese culture with loss of face, I think is a very powerful message. Of course, it depends on how paranoid you are. This guy's just been promoted. He's in charge of the military district in which the Defence National University for Defence Technology is located, who've just invited me to come over to talk about wargaming. Yes, I sent over, I'm going to talk about simulation, and there'll be a little bit about wargaming at the end. And they came back and said, yeah, can you squash the simulation bit down to like one lesson and make the rest about wargaming? So that'll be interesting, assuming my visa arrives, because I'm supposed to be off next week. Okay, I'm going to talk about types of wargaming. So I'll have a canter through. Most of you will know this stuff. If I'm going too fast, for anyone, stick your hand up. All the slides and hopefully the audio, providing I don't make too many obnoxious remarks, will be available on the website afterwards. Essentially two types of game. We have an open game in which everyone gets to see everything that's going on. All forces are in view and all the rules and assumptions are visible to everyone. These are very good if we're going to examine stuff conceptually. We're talking about things and how they work. Closed game has a fog of war. So that is, you should only have the information that would be available to you. So in most cases, that will be you can see your own forces, but you can only see those of the enemy with which you detect. But it can be more subtle than that. It could be that you are working to a set of rules that you understand and you feel comfortable about. It may be that the opposition are working to a completely different set of rules. So what is important to them in achieving victory is fundamentally different to the way that you think and what you think is achieving victory, which can produce some very interesting insights if you get it right. But in actual fact, most games are on a spectrum between these two extremes. And a standard closed game layout would have the red force and what the red can see of blue on one side, a master map with everything on it for the umpires, and then a blue map with what blue can see of red. Now, this works for manual games, but it also works for computer games, conceptually. So you can have simulation systems where a blue will discover red. The umpires, of course, are watching the master map and biting their nails, and the red team doing their bit. Now, some of those simulation systems are C1, C-all. So I'm the Italian Recce Brigade, and I find the enemy. Immediately, those enemy, because I found them, would appear on the British terminals. Now, in some respects, that's okay, but in other respects, it's not. Because, of course, part of the reason we're doing the war game is to examine how communication works. And if the Italian Recce Brigade doesn't report to the British, then they wouldn't get that information. So some computer systems, C1, C all, are designed for a smaller number and where you have a controller running the station and passing the information. Other games that are designed for the military user to use, you will see what you see, and no one else will see it unless you tell them, because the communication is more important than some of the underlying trends in the simulation. So quite important how that works. Okay, computer war games, easily recognizable, easy to make a closed game if you've got it on a LAN. All the algorithms are hidden. Now, this is good and this is bad. I have been to a leading establishment down at Warminster and with some of my colleagues, and we were asked to do a simulation about a TEWT, tactical exercise without troops. So the troops went out on the ground, they looked at a tactical problem, and then they came in. And the idea was to play it through in an adversarial manner after the TEWT. And we went down and we asked what the requirements are. Yes, you wanted to run it in about 45 minutes, maybe 90 minutes. It wanted to be adversarial. He wanted to run it with a syndicate. We were getting quite excited. And then at the end of it, he said, oh, yes, and it's got to be on a computer. I don't want any cardboard counters or paper map. And we all went, you know. I mean, I've worked in defense procurement quite a while, and I said, well, that's 20 million, Colonel, and you won't get it. And he was like, well, why not? I said, well, we've already bought one. If you start doing the requirements, it looks very like this system. Yeah, but that system's rubbish. Yeah, okay. Hiding the algorithms is because quite a lot of people are very uncomfortable rolling dice. Well, rolling dice is a grown-up conversation that you need to have. And if you're really not comfortable with rolling dice, and I was asked by a brigadier to take the two dice away and bring back 36 laminated cards which the chaps could choose from. He knew exactly what he was doing, and hiding the dice in 36 laminated cards solved the problem. He went on to become CGS, so I'll take his lead on that. There can be a steep learning curve. In most cases, manual wargaming, you can catch on very quickly. In a lot of computer simulations, you have to do training to a certain level before you can start working on it. Some people have an aptitude for it, and some people really don't. And it's not a function of how young you are or how old you are. General Jackson, the Corps commander of Headquarters ARC, came over and got a little bit of instruction on how to use the Abacus simulation, which is not easy, and then was able to come back and get on the system himself on his own, much to the panic of the corporal who was looking after the terminal. And the reason was, of course, the Corps commander wanted to check what his divisional commanders were doing, as opposed to what they said they were doing. Which, of course, is interesting. A lot of computer war games require a lengthy setup. And I'm not talking about lugging the computers in and putting the wires together. I'm talking about assembling a terrain database and getting the AUBATs in and the weapon capabilities in, and then realizing that the enemy are doing something subtly different to the way you've designed the AUBATs. One of which was, as I came across in Belgium, the Belgian guys had M113s with half-inch Brownings on the top, which is always great, and that's in the simulation. Of course, the guys dismounted the half-inch Brownings and lugged them about with them, which was a bit of a shock when we came against them, but couldn't be represented in the war game because we hadn't known that in advance. They're expensive. They're really expensive, some of them. And they can be cheap. COTS games are quite cheap. If we take that COTS game and make it into a military trainer, it will probably be 100 times more expensive. And the reason for that is we will need a ListX company able to be able to put classified data in. And that COTS game will go from being 100 times cheaper to about only 10 times cheaper. And then through life, they will become more expensive. So understanding the cost of putting together a computer game and realizing if it's for analysis, it might all be worth it. But if we're looking for that original thought, it almost certainly isn't. They can be very inflexible, and they don't represent the morale and stuff like that very well. And here's an example at the Defence Academy. Move on to map games. Now, this is using a military map, using a tourist map, just in case we go to Grenada, or anything like that. It facilitates close games very well in that three-map format. It's cheap and very easy to develop a game with practice. And Jim, in his next presentation, will talk about the design cycle and the steps that we need to go to. I'll skate over that later on in the presentation, but we'll get to those. Portable, flexible, not very good for very low level, line of sight and things like that, and it does require abstraction. Board war games are very easy to recognise and understand. They're very familiar to a lot of people. They tend towards more open games because we're looking at different things. They also tend to be highly structured and abstract, which is good because if you're looking for specific things. Portable, specialised, and excellent at looking at the concepts. And here we have a board war game dealing with, I think this was Hitler's henchman. But anyway, dealing with a leader and the political machinations of getting your project done when you've got an autocratic dictator in the middle. Nothing like defence procurement at all. Now, command decision and planning war games, and these cover a wide range of formats. They should be structured. Seminar, committee games, highly accessible, there are no rules. They're mainly about communication decisions. We've got a plan to do this, I've got a plan to do that. Hang on, we're both using the same vital resource and we don't have enough of it. That sort of thing. Fast and cheap, good for testing assumptions, but not really very good for combat. Seminar war games. And then, of course, we come on to sand table war games. And this is 3D models to represent the situation. You have to build the environment. There was a marvellous model which General DZ discovered at Santos, which is the whole of the North German plain, cut out of layers of felt by engineers. Absolutely incredible and beautiful. And you look at it and that's amazing. But you can't really carry it around unless you've got a very large truck and some forklifts. They're good for low-level tactical actions. They're very good for talking about equipment recognition. If you're going to pick up a 1 to 100 scale model and play with it, that is the best way at recognition training. And there's a good kinetic report that shows you why that is. Yes. There are first-person shooters that do quite well at that as well. And they do look a bit more sexy. And of course, you can be mistaken for playing with toy soldiers. And here's a marvellous, beautiful picture of, I think this is dealing with fighting in Berlin. I particularly love the Perspex houses with the little windows. Extraordinary how that was conducted. And then we've got a game specifically for soft issues, multi-party games with different actors. One of the things that has come across to me more recently was the importance of having skilled facilitation. If you try and run one of these and you've never seen one run before and you're only going on the description, it can be extremely difficult. They're great in areas of uncertainty, strong political content. They're highly portable, highly flexible, and require subtle analysis to understand, because they can quite easily be swayed by some of the starting conditions and the prompts that you're offering the players. So these are like role-playing conflict. You're the Syrian prime minister, you're the opposition, you're the US president. what are your roles and things like that. Matrix games, conceptual analysis games, role-playing games all fit into that. They can be incredibly good, and they can be incredibly awkward and awful if they're not done right. And here's an example of the ISIS crisis, which, thanks to Professor Rett, has ended up going all over the place, including the King's Royal Hussars officers' mess after dinner party, which was quite bizarre, playing in your black tie. It is quite useful using those sort of games for things like cyber, which are a bit more resistant to designing other types of games around them, so they're more suitable for that sort of thing. And then, of course, commercial off-the-shelf games. You simply buy something designed for, by somebody else, and you bend it to your purpose. So it can be a useful component. It's a very effective teaching aid in a lot of circumstances. You don't have to do the game design. Someone else has done it. And they're cheap to acquire. When I say you don't have to do the game design, you do have to do a lot of research to work out what's useful. Some of the games can be inaccessible, and the games are inflexible in that they have rules. Now, in some cases, that's very good, because you go, well, those are the rules. Military officers are supposed to analyse the problem. Well, the problem's contained in the rules. It's a fair fight, so the best man's going to win. So get on with it and stop sniveling that the rules are unfair. And Uwe Hallmann over at the Joint Air Power Competency Centre uses commercial games. So if you need advice on which ones will fit in a 90-minute period at your training establishment, he's the guy. And there are some games that are more abstract, give you an insight of things like insurgency, designed by an analyst with the CIA, and other games, straight commercial, Squad Leader, used by One Royal Irish, although he actually used Advanced Squad Leader, which I would never recommend to anyone. but he got his subalterns doing a proper analysis of the game, producing the sorts of products they would require, and getting on with it. In reality, game designs can feature some or all of these. And business games tend to be more like seminar war games and role-playing. Normally, a lot less combat resolution, normally. So when we considered Libya, we had a problem. It was very short notice. We only had about a week's notice between the government deciding and having to come up with a plan. It wasn't foreseen. In some cases, you can foresee it, but then the government specifically forbids you from doing any planning about it. The Scottish referendum. Okay, we were not allowed to do any planning in case. Fascinating. Obviously, very perceptive, because we would have wasted some money if we did that. And of course, the scale and scope of the Libya operation and how much time and money would you need. We didn't have simulation systems with terrain databases of Libya to the level of detail. We didn't have simulation systems that would allow us to do the target recognition and selection that we needed of Libya. So a proposal was put out to put out a manual war game. And so we ended up with something that a lot of people would recognise: paper map, cardboard counters, and a manual system, which will be demonstrated later, so I won't go into it, other than to offer the quote from two guys who were actually there when they did the validation. I wish I'd had we'd had such a system with us. Okay, I'll give you an example just before we finish. At Sandhurst, the commandant, who will be here tomorrow, is trying to reintroduce wargaming into Sandhurst. We want to inculcate original thinking, manoeuvrist approach amongst our subalterns. So it's going to be reintroduced. It's going to be part of the course. It's not going to be part of recreation. There will be a wargames club on a Wednesday evening or whatever, but this is part of the course. Will consist of a lecture, a war game, introduction to staff at one level. There will be Kriegsspiel, which the Commandant will talk about tomorrow, as part of the war studies bit. But the bit I was tasked to deal with is actually part of the CHUT. So they will do a CHUT, tactical exercise on the ground, analysis of a problem, and then at the end of it, they're going to do a war game. So I have got to design that. So what is the purpose? Creating knowledge, conveying knowledge, entertainment. I don't think it's entertainment. Who's it for? Is it the commandant? Is it for the directing staff? Is it for the students? I am going to have to sell it to the directing staff. I don't think the commandant will come and have a look unless the directing staff are happy that it's good enough. I don't want to waste his time. He is an important guy. So when I'm producing this, I've got to get past the directing staff before I can expose it to the students. Who's going to participate? Well, the students are going to participate. The staff is going to participate. Will I be there? Well, no. I'm going to be there perhaps for one or two, and then they are going to have to deliver it. Guys who've never delivered war games before. The majority of them. And what constraints? How long have I got? Oh, yeah, the tutor will finish at 3 o'clock, and they don't have to go to supper till 7, so you've got all that time. Yeah. So how many guys here have been on a tute? Yeah. How many of those tute finished on time? Yeah, okay. Oh, I then found out when I went for the second meeting that they're actually going to do the game on the tute. So if it's pouring with rain, they'll back 2 four-tonners up and they'll do it in the back of the... Wow. Yeah. So it's going to have to be robust and portable. And this is something unfamiliar that the DS have never faced. So how are we going to cover that? Well, I produced a map. Originally, I didn't have any grids on it, but there weren't grids, with some counters. It's going to be a free Kriegsspiel. The DS are combat veterans, all of them. So with a little bit of structure and some counters, this is the tactical problem that they're facing. The enemy are on Cheese Hill. Which way are you going to go? And most people go, oh, I'm going to go right flanking behind this ridge here. And then I'll either go through the woods and attack this way, or I'm going to get here because I'm going to be in dead ground and I'm going to attack that way. Or whatever. Except, of course, it will be double blind, so there will be a team of red players doing it. And I can absolutely guarantee that at the end of the day, of all the analysis, the red will have this approach covered. And it's fascinating to see how quickly the plans unwind when they give it a go. Very simple, no rules, and at this stage rolling dice is inappropriate. They're not that advanced in their program. We're trying to teach them the basics, the understanding of the planning. We're going to be taking risk into account later on in the program as a more advanced topic. So this is only part of what the commandant's plan is. It's a crawl, walk, run approach. And later on, they will be doing it at a much higher level than moving a couple of sections on a single grid square of Aldershot countryside. So, if we do manual wargaming, we get the marvellous good, fast or cheap. But if you design it right, you can have it all. Of course, I would say that, wouldn't I? So, we've looked at what we're trying to achieve. We've looked at one or two of the subtleties of how and why we're going to achieve it. Some design criteria that you need to bear in mind. You do have to sell it to someone who's paying for it. And they have the ability to ruin it or to take it forward. And that's important because they are paying for it. It is their train set. You do have to understand your resource limitations of time, space and materials and the design cycle. And that's where we come on to Jim Warman, who will talk about the design process. Thank you very much. Jim. Thank you.